KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
This man is already doing more in less than 24 hours than his predecessor did in 4 years. Yesterday was a historic day for President Trump.
It is President Trump's first full day back in the White House. What has he done?
We'll tell you this Tuesday, January 21st on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The U.S. Gulf Coast is experiencing a rare winter storm.
Snow, sleet, and ice are making travel conditions treacherous across the region.
This morning, we did issue our first ever blizzard warning here.
Also, public health experts respond to President Trump's decision to withdraw the U.S. from the World Health Organization.
And we hear from actor Naomi Watts about her new book.
She talks about an experience millions of women have each year, but one that made her feel completely alone.
Every single woman, if they're lucky enough, we'll go through menopause.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Some January 6 rioters serving jail time for their roles in the attack on the U.S. Capitol are now free. That includes the leader of the Proud Boys, a group that played a prominent role in the events of that day. They were freed in a sweeping clemency issued for 1,500 plus people last night by President Donald Trump. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports.
Already we're seeing people being released from prisons and jails, including Enrique Tarrio. He's the former chairman of the far-right Proud Boys group, and he had been serving a prison term of 22 years. He's now free, according to his lawyer, Naib Hassan.
I can tell you Enrique is looking forward to moving forward with his life and being a productive member of society.
Several other members of the Proud Boys also won pardons, and some had their sentences commuted.
NPR's Carrie Johnson. Trump freed individuals convicted of plotting to interrupt the peaceful transfer of power and of assaulting police officers after his 2020 election loss. New York Representative Lee Stefanik is telling senators she'll push Trump's America First agenda at the UN if she's confirmed as the next U.S. ambassador there. She's also vowing to review U.S. funding of United Nations agencies. More from NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
Even before Lee Stefanik appeared at her confirmation hearing, President Trump signed an executive order pulling the U.S. out of the World Health Organization. Stefanik says the Trump administration will review all funding at UN agencies.
Our tax dollars should not be complicit in propping up entities that are counter to American interests, anti-Semitic, or engaging in fraud, corruption, or terrorism.
If confirmed, she said she would work to counter China's influence at the UN and defend Israel. She even sided with far-right Israeli politicians who claim Israel has a biblical right to the West Bank, the occupied Palestinian territory. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The Deep South is experiencing both bitter cold and a rare wave of snow and ice. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports more than 30 million people across the region are under a winter storm warning.
Forecasters say this is a once-in-a-generation storm that's dumped more than 10 inches of snow in parts of the Gulf Coast. Meteorologist Stacy Denson is with the National Weather Service in Lake Charles, Louisiana.
But it is just really just crazy, I guess, is the best way to describe seeing this amount of snow. I'm actually from the area, so grew up down here, and this is just nothing like I've ever experienced.
She says whiteout conditions early in the day prompted forecasters to issue an unprecedented blizzard warning. Parts of I-10 are closed, and thousands of flights have been canceled. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Orange Beach, Alabama.
The Dow was up 537 points. This is NPR. A first day executive action taken by the Trump administration keeps the video sharing app TikTok up and running for the next 75 days, giving the platform's Chinese owners more time to find a U.S. buyer. ByteDance missed its January 19th deadline to sell the platform, but Trump's order says his administration will not enforce the law banning the app. Trump has promised to keep the social media platform open, crediting it with helping him win re-election. However, Trump's legal authority to preserve TikTok under terms of U.S. Supreme Court ruling is not clear. Space turns out to be kind of chatty. NPR's Regina Barber reports on a natural phenomenon that produces bursts of radiation scientists call chorus waves.
That sound isn't from Star Trek. It's an audio clip created from radiation coming 100,000 miles above Earth's surface. These waves are thought to be created from bunched-up, charged electrons trapped in Earth's magnetic field. These rising and lowering waves of radiation have been studied for the past 70 years. And a new study from Beijing, China, published in the journal Nature, was the first to find these waves at this location, where Earth's magnetic field is weak and less uniform. This information could help protect satellites and other spacecraft from damage, since chorus waves can accelerate particles to close to the speed of light. Regina Barber, NPR News.
With a pair of talks now of a possible settlement, a high-stakes trial pitting Britain's Prince Harry against Rupert Murdoch's UK tabloids is on hold. Harry, the younger son of King Charles and one other claimant, contend the publisher of The Sun hacked their phones and unlawfully snooped on them. The publisher has denied the allegations. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org.
Right now, Alaska has thousands of youth that need a home where they can feel safe, supported, and loved. As a therapeutic foster parent, you'll work with a dedicated team to provide care and guidance for youth in need, help them stay closer to their communities, and get the support they need to thrive. To learn more about how you can become a therapeutic foster parent and help youth in your community, visit fostercarealaska.org. This message sponsored by Denali Family Services and AK Child and Family.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. It's the first full day in office for President Trump, and he's been spending time on some of his biggest priorities, working with congressional Republicans on a legislative plan to cut...
Massive data centers. And they said it will be a $100 billion investment right out of the gate and up to $500 billion over the next 4 years. Here's Trump.
Creating over 100,000 American jobs almost immediately. This monumental undertaking is a resounding declaration of confidence in America's potential under a new president. A new president, I didn't say it, they did.
The business leaders did credit Trump with making this happen, getting this built in America. Sohn even echoed Trump's language about it being a golden age for America. That kind of thing doesn't happen overnight. Trump, when he was president before, was known for bringing in executives for big, splashy announcements. And it appears that it is resumed with this.
Okay. And we know that Trump was also holding meetings with congressional leaders. Did anything come out of those sessions?
Well, you know, to follow through on some of the biggest campaign promises, Trump is going to need help from Congress, which is narrowly controlled by Republicans. He wants to extend and expand tax cuts passed during his first term. And he needs a whole lot of funding and other policy changes to fully enact his immigration agenda. In the meeting today with GOP leaders, they settled on a path forward, a tactical plan. My colleague Deirdre Walsh reports that they agreed to move his agenda in one big bill. And Trump said this afternoon that he thinks he's going to be able to get it done more easily now by connecting it with disaster relief funding for the California wildfires. He figures Democrats want disaster funding so badly they could vote for it.
Okay, last thing before we let you go. We know that President Trump has signed stacks and stacks of executive actions. A lot of action there. Has the dust started to settle? What do we know about those?
Yeah, not really. White House officials are still just getting their email accounts set up. And as you might expect with this much activity, there are a lot of unanswered questions about how some of his orders and proclamations will actually be implemented. It is very likely that Trump signs even more orders this week. We've already seen websites come down for programs that Trump ended by executive action. And there's a new site for the Department of Government Efficiency, which just has an image of a cartoon dog and a golden dollar sign with the slogan, "The people voted for major reform." And this is certainly a period of major and sudden change.
That is NPR's Tamara Keith. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
It's been many years since parts of the Gulf Coast have seen what's falling from the sky today: snow. Ice and sleet hit areas stretching from Houston across New Orleans all the way to Florida. More than 30 million people are under a winter storm warning. NPR's Debbie Elliott is in the middle of it and joins us from her home in Orange Beach, Alabama. Hi, Debbie.
Hey, Ari.
Got snow at the beach down there?
We do. It's just insane. It's coming down very hard. We've had about 3 inches in our little rain gauge that we keep on the back deck. And the weight of the snow is so heavy that it's starting to pull down the palm fronds in the front yard. Mm. It's bitterly cold. Winds are gusting about 15 miles an hour. So at times, the snow is actually blowing sideways, kind of like the rain does when we get hurricanes. It is surreal. I cannot remember any meaningful snowfall here in the 30 plus years that I've lived here. It's beautiful to look out the window and see it, but otherwise we should let people know that this storm is really disrupting the Gulf Coast.
Tell us about those disruptions. What's happening?
You know, obviously travel and traffic accidents with the ice and snow piling up in places that rarely see it. So people aren't necessarily equipped to drive in it, and communities aren't really ready for it. These little beach towns along the Gulf Coast don't have snow plows or stockpiles of road salt to go. So the message has been, people should just consider all roads and bridges impassable. In Louisiana, the state has closed those big bridges that cross Lake Pontchartrain and the Mississippi River. The state's also closed large chunks of Interstate 10, so travel is just not really easy around here. All of the Gulf state governors have declared states of emergency and want people to stay put, to shelter in place, and to be prepared for potential power and water outages in this extremely cold weather. A lot of businesses are closed, so our schools and colleges, and then, of course, airports are shut down with thousands of flights canceled or delayed.
Forecasters are calling this a once-in-a-generation storm that could make history. Are people going to be telling their grandkids about this?
I think so. You know, and it already has made history, according to Stacy Denson. She's a meteorologist I spoke with earlier today. She's at the National Weather Service in Lake Charles, Louisiana.
This morning, we did issue our first ever blizzard warning here. First ever one that's ever been issued in all of Louisiana, because we were seeing basically whiteout conditions.
So a whiteout in Louisiana and the first ever blizzard warning. You know, these are forecasters who are more accustomed to dealing with hurricanes coming up in the Gulf of Mexico, not the Gulf serving up this frigid moisture. Forecasters say this storm is producing historic snowfall amounts. Some places in Louisiana have already gotten more than 9 inches.
Well, I hope people are at least taking the opportunity to have some fun with it.
Oh, absolutely. There was a picture I saw earlier of two people skiing down Bourbon Street in New Orleans. There are jokes about, you know, making snow angels on the white sand beaches that are now covered with an even fluffier layer of white. Our colleague Audrey McGlinchey at member station KUT in Austin, Texas, was out talking with people in the snow today. She sent this from Anna Connolly, who was so excited to see the snow first thing that she was still wearing her slippers.
It's like a present. I feel like we never really get snow here that actually sticks. And so waking up and being like, I have to get out of the house right now. And then everyone acts like it's summer camp. Everyone's running around and being like, do you see the snow? It's just cute.
So cute, but also wind chills going to be dangerously low tonight. Another reason officials, again, asking people to just stay put.
NPR's Debbie Elliott from the winter wonderland of Orange Beach, Alabama. Enjoy your hot cocoa or bourbon or whatever you got.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ari.
Monday was a long day for President Trump as he signed dozens of executive actions and orders. And then in the evening, an aide handed him another one.
What is this? Withdrawing from the World Health Organization, sir?
Ooh, that's a big one.
The president then signed the order initiating the withdrawal of the United States from the World Health Organization. It will take a year for the process of withdrawal to be complete. NPR global health correspondent Fatma Tanis has this reaction from public health experts.
The decision to withdraw didn't come as a surprise. Back in 2020, President Trump had started the process for pulling out of the organization, but President Biden reversed course when he took office 6 months later. This time, though, the scope of the order was broader, according to Brett Schaefer, senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank.
Much broader than just withdrawing from the WHO. He immediately suspended funding. He also instructed the U.S. government to recall and reassign any USG personnel and contractors working with the WHO.
The U.S. is the biggest financial contributor to the WHO and provides a lot of technical expertise. Critics of the WHO say it failed to prevent the COVID-19 pandemic and that the organization in general lacks transparency. President Trump says the U.S. pays a disproportionate amount to the WHO in assessed dues, and that other countries like China need to pull more of the financial weight. In a statement, the WHO said, quote, that it regrets the U.S. announcement and hopes it will reconsider. Many global health experts say U.S. withdrawal is a big blow to global health security. Pete Baker is with the Center for Global Development. He says the WHO plays an important role in sharing data on infectious diseases and tackling epidemics.
They are a key player in making sure, you know, data is shared between countries on things like antimicrobial resistance, you know, the rise of the superbugs. This is of concern to all of us, and these bugs don't respect borders. They travel between countries easily, and the WHO is key to trying to move that issue forward. And so if they are less able to do that, then we're all more at risk.
Without participating in the WHO, Baker says it's unclear how the U.S. will be able to communicate and coordinate responses to major global public health issues, such as the ongoing bird flu outbreak.
This has never happened before. This is unprecedented. It may be the U.S. decides to do a bunch of bilateral arrangements on these issues or something, but I don't see how this is going to work.
But Schaefer with the Heritage Foundation says the U.S. role in global health is far bigger than its membership in the WHO.
I think that a lot of the people that are out raising cries of alarm about this are not fully appreciating the role that the United States plays internationally.
The U.S. provides $12 billion in global health assistance each year through other organizations like the United Nations and directly to low-income countries.
The fact that the executive order is focused very much on the WHO, I think, indicates that this is a specific organizational complaint.
And it's not, he says, a revocation of U.S. support for international health. Fatma Tanis, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1.
Alaska News Nightly features not only the most important statewide news of the day, but also the most intriguing.
So they're violating the law every time they go on the Pegger and Johansson Road.
And because the permanent fund's such a big part of the state budget, that means everything else gets affected.
That's on Alaska News Nightly, weeknights at 6 p.m. on FM 91.1, wherever you listen to podcasts, or check out alaskapublic.org.
A historic working farm in Palmer is home to a unique outdoor education experience that blends agriculture, a master's degree program, and an elementary school designed for local homeschoolers. Join Outdoor Explorer at the Kellogg campus in Palmer as we immerse ourselves in the outdoors as education. That's on Outdoor Explorer this Thursday at 10 a.m., repeating at 8 p.m. on Alaska Public Media, FM 91.1, or alaskapublic.org.
Attention Chugach Electric Association members. One director will be elected to the Chugach Electric Board in the upcoming 2025 election. Chugach members interested in helping shape Alaska's energy future are encouraged to apply. Chugach Electric Association is also accepting proposals for bylaw changes. This is an opportunity to help refine the rules that guide the cooperative. Applications for the Board of Directors and bylaw changes are due by 5 p.m. Monday, January 27, 2025. Visit ChugachElectric.com or call 907-762-4489 for forms, bylaws, and more information. This message sponsored by Chugach Electric Association.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The actor Naomi Watts tells a story about a doctor's appointment. At the time she had just finished filming King Kong, she wanted to have a baby, and she was having trouble getting pregnant. But the doctor examined her and pronounced, "Looks like you're close to menopause." Watts was 36 years old. She almost fell off the exam table. Naomi Watts writes about that moment in her new book, Dare I Say It? Everything I Wish I'd Known About Menopause. Naomi Watts, welcome.
Thank you, Mary Louise. It's good to be here.
Why did you almost fall off the exam table that day?
I think I was just shocked. Here I was wanting to begin a new chapter of my life, and I was slammed with this news of, well, actually, you're close to the end.
And it's really young, 36. It must have felt so young.
Yes. I was obviously later than my mom coming to the world of parenting, but I still felt pretty young, certainly by standards that were going on in urban places. You were seeing people getting pregnant in their 40s, even late 40s, early 50s. So I was pretty shocked and went into a massive panic. And my doctor was very compassionate and very, you know, he didn't mean to scare me, but I just found it to be just the worst possible news.
Well, and I was struck that you say you felt completely alone as you navigated this, because you quote a statistic: every year, 2 million American women enter menopause. If I'm doing my math right, that's 5,000 or 6,000 women a day. And this is not a rare, unique experience. But you felt completely alone. Why?
Yeah. Well, because the conversation was completely closed. It's ridiculous, given those statistics. Every single woman, if they're lucky enough, will go through menopause. It's really staggering how there is still a hangover for, you know, keeping it a secret. Mm. And the rest of us who are not going to go through menopause should know about it.
So to preview your book a little, Naomi Watts, you've got chapters here on everything from your own infertility story to skincare and what we might want to wear as women age. If I were to sum up the most important advice you're offering to women based on your own journey, would it be that, look, if you're feeling out of control, if you're feeling unsure about what's happening to your body, get yourself to the doctor, advocate for yourself, ask for help?
Yeah, absolutely.
How did you learn how to do that?
It took a long time. It really did. I flailed around in secrecy and shame before I could piecemeal information and get myself into a place where I felt brave enough to speak to others. My doctor walked me through the whole hormone therapy, the world of that. Mm. So I was able to deal with symptom relief very quickly because I was suffering. And I had been filling out plenty of medical forms for years saying that I was suffering night sweats. I had no idea they were connected to menopause. I just thought menopause was hot flushes and that's it. And how dumb of me, but that's all that was available, really.
Well, if I may, I would say not dumb at all. You can't know what you don't know and what you don't know what to ask for. Stay on this for a second. The HRT, hormone replacement therapy, it has been really controversial. The advice has been all over the map. You're not a doctor. You're not prescribing anything here, but you do weigh in with the strong view that HRT is an excellent option for many women and that it is safer than we have been led to believe.
Mm-hmm.
Elaborate on that.
Yeah, I'm not trying to profess to be a doctor at all. I want everyone to investigate this based on their medical history. But I do encourage people to go to a doctor who is going to give them the full spectrum of options based on their medical history. As far as I am concerned, it has offered me great help with symptom relief. You know, I was going through nights of changing my clothes and setting towels down and moving to one side of the bed to the other, you know. And when you're not able to sleep and you're going through those night sweats, it can cause a whole barrage of other symptoms like anxiety the next day, brain fog, depression, the list goes on. So I really needed to get my symptoms under control.
And can we just be specific for a second here? Because hormone replacement therapy sounds like this really scary thing. For you, it was what, like a little dot that you put on your hip or something?
Well, there are many different ways to distribute. And I started with just a spray of estrogen. And I've certainly moved around from one thing to the next, progressed in dosages and different forms of distribution. I then went to a patch and then I went to a pill and now I'm on a gel and it's coupled with progesterone. So it takes time to research it. And as I said, everybody has to come at it on their own terms with their doctor.
You end the book by asking, what if the point of menopause is to break up with our former self, like to leave behind who we were, embrace this whole new chapter of exploring and experimenting?
Yes.
And I read that and I thought, how great is that?
Yeah, it's like a return to yourself. You're not being governed by hormones anymore, making odd decisions sometimes.
Well, I don't know. I can't blame all of my odd decisions on hormones.
No, definitely not. But I think it can be freeing. Now, perhaps the kids are grown enough or they've left the house already, or depending how and when it hits you, maybe I can focus on me a bit more. What do I want here? And, you know, am I happy in my job? Am I happy in my marriage? Have I done enough? And yeah, for me, there have been some great new things. And I've been, pinching myself for many years for a number of great things that have taken place in my life. I got married just recently.
Congratulations.
That was a big thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't expect to meet someone at this point in my life. You know, if I was in my 20s, I never would have predicted that. Things are possible still. It's definitely not the end. We are not invisible.
Amen to that. Yeah.
I'm looking at the women in these films lately, particularly this year. There's a number, more than a handful, of great dynamic stories about women in this age group, which are really wonderful stories. And that's heartening to me. So I do think there's a massive change taking place, and it's wonderful to witness.
That is the actor and now also writer, Naomi Watts. Her new book is, dare I say it, Everything I Wish I'd Known About Menopause. Naomi Watts, thank you.
Thank you so much, Mary Louise.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media
on KSKA Anchorage,
FM 91.1.
Connecting Alaskans.
Life informed.
Listen to Marketplace on KSKA Anchorage for business and economic news that's clear and understandable. Marketplace provides news on stocks, bonds, real estate, business, employment, and economic trends and can be heard at 1 p.m. and again at 6:30 p.m. here on FM 91.1.
I'm Jeff Bennett. On the next NewsHour, President Trump begins to implement his agenda after taking office for a second term. That's Tuesday on the PBS NewsHour.
Weekdays at 7 p.m. on Alaska Public Media, FM 91.1.
Alaskans of all ages are choosing to include Alaska Public Media in their wills, and we're honored to share in their legacy. Learn more at alaskapublic.org/legacy.
Support for Alaska Public Media comes from sustaining members and from
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, offering guests hot breakfast, Wi-Fi, and the Red Lantern Steak and Spirits Restaurant. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The Trump administration's new border czar, Tom Homan, says federal immigration officials can now enter schools, healthcare facilities, and places of worship to conduct immigration arrests. Homan says that agents are now focusing on those who are considered a public safety threat.
We need to stop the bleeding, right? We can keep bailing the water out of the boat, but we got to plug those holes. So right now, it's all about securing this nation, securing the border, and we'll address that in the coming days. But right now, we're going to shut that border down and get a hold of this problem.
Homan said the actions are not raids, but, quote, targeted enforcement operations. President Trump has also designated several Mexican drug cartels as foreign terrorist organizations, holding out the possibility of using military force. Trump has also threatened to slap a 25% tariff on goods from Mexico beginning next month. Well, students who accused Harvard University of failing to curb anti-Semitism on campus and violating federal civil rights law have settled with the school. NPR's Tovia Smith says Harvard has agreed, among other things, to adopting a broader definition of anti-Semitism.
The new definition considers some cases of anti-Zionist or anti-Israel criticism as anti-Semitic, for example, calling for the death of Zionists or excluding Zionists or Israelis from school activities. Harvard also agreed to share how it handles complaints of anti-Semitism as compared to other forms of bias. The settlement includes unspecified monetary terms, but Harvard did not admit any wrongdoing. A spokesman says the deal reflects Harvard's commitment to embracing, respecting, and supporting Jews on campus. The move drew angry rebukes from a Palestinian solidarity group on campus. It says Harvard is using a, quote, widely contested definition of anti-Semitism to silence support for Palestinians. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
This is NPR. Israel's top general says he will resign in March after reaching a ceasefire last weekend that halted a 15-month war with Hamas in Gaza, securing the release of some hostages. NPR's Jerome Sokolovsky has more.
Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi is the most senior figure to resign since October 7, 2023. On that day, militants from Gaza stormed into Israel and killed around 1,200 people. They also took hostages and still hold more than 90. The chief of staff said the military's failure that day accompanies me every day, hour by hour, and will do so for the rest of my life. But he added that the military's achievements since then have, quote, altered the Middle East. Opposition leaders are calling on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to accept responsibility for October 7th and step down as well. Jerome Sokolovsky, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
A winter blast of bitterly cold temperatures is gripping nearly three-fourths of the country, hitting areas from Connecticut in the north to as far away as Texas in the south with snow, closing highways, grounding flights in New Orleans and Houston today, even prompting the first-ever blizzard warnings in some areas. Forecasters say the frigid temperatures are expected to last for the remainder of this week. On Wall Street, stocks finished higher across the board. This is NPR.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media
on KSKA Anchorage,
FM 91.1.
Connecting Alaskans.
Life informed.
A
historic working farm in Palmer is home to a unique outdoor education experience that blends agriculture, a master's degree program, and an elementary school designed for local homeschoolers. Join Outdoor Explorer at the Kellogg campus in Palmer as we immerse ourselves in the outdoors as education. That's on Outdoor Explorer this Thursday at 10 a.m., repeating at 8 p.m. on Alaska Public Media, FM 91.1, or alaskapublic.org.
Connect with Alaska Public Media on Instagram for daily content, news, videos, and events updates. Just click follow at Alaska Public.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Israeli forces announced a new military operation this morning, this time in the occupied West Bank. It started with an airstrike that killed at least 9 Palestinians and wounded dozens more, according to Palestinian health officials. That's as the ceasefire in Gaza is holding on its third day. To talk more about all this, we're joined by NPR's Kat Lonsdorf, who was just in the West Bank. Hi, Kat.
Hey, Ari.
Tell us more about this new military operation. What's going on?
Yeah, it's in Jenin, which is a city and a refugee camp in the northern area of the West Bank. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office put out a statement about it, calling it a, quote, significant military operation to combat terrorism. Jenin has long been a militant stronghold. There have been numerous Israeli military raids there over the past 15 months while the war in Gaza has been going on. Netanyahu said the goal of this operation was to, quote, strengthen security in the West Bank to protect Israel. They're calling it Operation Iron Wall.
Tell us about the timing. This is coming just days after a ceasefire was implemented in Gaza.
Yeah, this isn't the first military operation in Jenin, but the timing is notable. This comes at a time when Netanyahu is under a lot of pressure, particularly from the far-right members of his government, to show that he's taking their concerns about the security of Israel seriously. Many of them, particularly his finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, are very against the ceasefire deal with Hamas. Another far-right member of Netanyahu's government just resigned over this. Smotrich has been very vocal about his goal of Israel annexing the West Bank eventually, and some analysts see an operation like this as a way of appeasing him for the ceasefire deal that he's so against. Meanwhile, Palestinians in the West Bank are worried that the Israeli military will now shift its focus over there with a ceasefire in Gaza. I was in Jenin last fall after the last major Israeli military operation there. And even then, people there told me that they felt like Jenin was becoming Gaza. The level of destruction by the Israeli military was just so great.
And in Gaza, on the third day of this ceasefire, what is the state of things?
Yeah, it's holding, like you said. The ceasefire has allowed for a lot of very much needed humanitarian aid to enter. The UN says yesterday, 915 trucks got in. There were more than 600 the day before. And just to put that in perspective, that's more aid in 2 days than got in some entire months this fall. It's making up for severe deficits. There's still a lot of work to do. In terms of how people there are feeling, I asked our producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, that earlier today, and he told me that people there are still hesitant, but it does feel different. Here's part of a voice note he sent to me.
There is no drones in the skies. The atmosphere is quiet. People can walk in the streets even after the nightfall, which is something newish for us, all of us. For the aid, we do hear that there is aid enters into Gaza, but we cannot see it yet on the markets. We cannot solve the problems, all of the problems in 3 days, but at least there is some relief.
You know, he told me with all of the destruction and devastation, there's still a long, long road ahead.
And in Israel, the military's top general announced he was resigning today. What reason did he give?
That's Herzi Halevi. He's the most senior military officer to resign since the October 7th attacks in 2023. Those were the Hamas-led attacks on southern Israel that killed around 1,200 people and took more than 250 hostage into Gaza. It also started this recent war in Gaza. Around 47,000 Palestinians have been killed in that war with Israel, according to health officials. In his announcement, Halevi said that he was responsible for the military's failure on October 7th and that it accompanies him every day of his life. He said he was relinquishing his duties effective early March. Meanwhile, opposition leaders have been calling on Netanyahu to accept responsibility for October 7th too and step down as well. That is unlikely to happen.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump's top diplomat is diving into his job. Marco Rubio was confirmed unanimously in the Senate last night, and he is at the State Department today, hosting foreign ministers from India, Japan, and Australia. NPR's Michelle Kellerman was there as the new Secretary of State arrived.
Just days after former Secretary of State Antony Blinken said his farewell to the department, hundreds of staffers were back in the C Street lobby to welcome their new boss.
Colleagues, the 72nd Secretary of State, Marco Rubio.
The first Latino in this post, Rubio arrived with his family, saying he might be new to the job, but he's no stranger to the work of the State Department, having served on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and visited many embassies abroad.
This is an extraordinary honor and a privilege to serve in this role, to be here, frankly, to oversee the greatest, the most effective, the most talented, the most experienced diplomatic corps in the history of the world resides in this building.
Rubio seemed to be trying to put staffers at ease as the Trump administration takes aim at career government officials. Several officials who have already been pushed aside were standing beside him on the staircase in the main lobby.
There will be changes, but the changes are not meant to be destructive. They're not meant to be punitive. They're not out of the changes will be because we need to be a 21st century agency that can move by a cliche that's used by many at the speed of relevance. But we need to move faster than we ever have because the world is changing faster than we ever have.
Rubio says he's watched the State Department get sidelined in both Democratic and Republican administrations in the past, and he says he wants to make sure the department is at the center of American foreign policy now as the world grapples with wars in Ukraine, Sudan, and the Middle East. His first task was hosting a meeting of the so-called Quad, the U.S., Japan, Australia, and India. It's a diplomatic grouping that's been a counterweight to China, which will likely be a big focus for Rubio, a longtime China hawk. Countering China was also one of the themes of today's confirmation hearing for Trump's pick to be the next UN ambassador, Elise Stefanik.
I believe we need to have a strategy to push back, particularly on the CCP's inroads within the global south and even within the Western Hemisphere.
And, she added, in the United Nations itself. But Democrats are raising concerns about President Trump's first foreign policy steps, taking the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord and the World Health Organization. Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen says these actions will only cede ground to U.S. adversaries in the United Nations.
Sadly, President Trump's decision to leave the World Health Organization will do just that. I believe it will make us less safe. Viruses don't respect national boundaries.
Another Democrat, Hawaii Senator Brian Schatz, put it this way.
I know WHO is a done deal. I know Paris is a done deal. Fair enough. Elections and consequences and all of that. But I am worried that we're going to just get out of the room and then relegate ourselves to observer status and then wonder why we're losing the battle in the room.
Stefanik defended Trump's first foreign policy steps, including a 90-day pause on all development assistance. Like Secretary of State Rubio, she said this administration will only pay for things that it believes will make America stronger, safer, and more prosperous. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Since the pandemic, schools across the country have been struggling with kids missing school, and if a student is gone at least 10% of the year, it's considered chronic absenteeism. In Florida, one school district says part of the problem is that kids can't always get to school. So they've come up with a solution: give students bikes. Danielle Pryor with Central Florida Public Media has the story.
Hey, guys.
It's a beautiful sunny day, and Harold Bennett's daughter, Amani, is getting a new bike at her elementary school in DeLand, Florida, just west of Daytona Beach.
I'm very excited. She's been asking about a bike for a long time.
Her new metallic purple bike comes with a matching helmet, and almost immediately after putting it on, she starts riding circles around her dad. Amani Bennett is in the fourth grade and already has big dreams. Her favorite subject is science, and she wants to be
A vet doctor, or maybe like a bike rider.
But in order to achieve those dreams, she needs to be in class. She's already considered at risk for chronic absenteeism like a handful of other kids at her school. A local hospital donated the money for the 168 bikes and helmets. They're for kids in the district who regularly miss school, says school board member Ruben Colon.
This is very intentional to address chronic absenteeism and ensure that we're able to remove those barriers from our students and ensure that they are in class.
The reason bikes are needed here is that Florida has a very rare state law that says most kids who live within a 2-mile radius of school can't take the bus. The idea is that kids could walk to school. Most parents just drive their kids, says Stetson University education professor Rajni Shankar Brown.
I think families that do have transportation, I know several chose to do that as opposed to letting their student walk.
But she says not every family has a car or a work schedule that allows for drop-off and pickup. And she's worried about kids biking to school on their own.
We don't really have bike infrastructure built. So there are a lot of high traffic areas with inadequate infrastructure for cyclists. And so this worries me.
She would like every child to be able to take the bus. She says just last year, a 10-year-old elementary student in the district was killed riding her bike to school. The regional Advent Health Hospital system donated the bikes. Its CEO, David Weiss, says they're aware of the risks, and that's why kids are also learning the rules of the road.
Of course, as these bikes were given to the students, they were given a helmet as well with them, but they're also learning all about bike safety through their PE education program.
Kids can ride their bikes on sidewalks here, and there are crossing guards. Plus, Weiss says the bikes are a good way to fight chronic absenteeism and get some exercise.
It's a perfect time for these young people to get their bikes and to be able to put safe bike handling practices into effect so they can stay safe as they use these bikes for fun and for transportation.
There is a goal for this bike program. The district hopes it'll reduce chronic absenteeism by 10% by the end of the 2024-2025 school year. For NPR News, I'm Danielle Pryor at an elementary school in DeLand, Florida.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage.
Alaska News Nightly features not only the most important statewide news of the day, but also the most intriguing.
So they're violating the law every time they go on the Pegger and Johansson Road.
And because the permanent fund's such a big part of the state budget, that means everything else gets affected.
That's on Alaska News Nightly, weeknights at 6 p.m. on FM 91.1, wherever you listen to podcasts, or check out alaskapublic.org.
Are you a high school student interested in free college? Matsu Middle College School offers an advanced course of study for Matsu Borough School District juniors and seniors. Students take both high school and college courses while completing their high school graduation requirements. Students are provided free college tuition, textbooks, and a computer. For more information, come to the Glenn Massey Theater, 6:30 p.m. on January 28th. Matsu Middle College School is the place to be. This message sponsored by Matsu Middle College School.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1. I'm Tobin Shelby. We're coming up on 4:50 p.m., 32 degrees, overcast skies in the Anchorage area. Similar conditions, a bit warmer, high 30s in the Mat-Su. In Anchorage tonight, scattered snow showers possible. Otherwise, mostly cloudy, lows around 30. And some light winds that could gust up to 20 miles per hour at times. Tomorrow, scattered snow showers, then rain mixing with snow in the later afternoon. Highs near 36 with light winds continuing. Sunrise tomorrow, 9:41. Sunset, 4:41. That's 6 hours, 59 minutes, 17 seconds of daylight. You're listening to Alaska Public Media.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Last night, as he was signing a flurry of executive actions at the Oval Office, President Trump said he's thinking about imposing 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico by February 1st. Trump has long loved tariffs, but this move could set off a trade war with America's two closest neighbors, partners in a trade deal that Trump himself pushed for in his first term. NPR White House correspondent Asma Hawley joins us now. Hi there.
Hi there.
Asma, start if you can by telling us more about what Trump is saying he's going to do.
Trump, you know, sees tariffs as both a negotiation tactic and as a way to raise revenue. He had been threatening sweeping tariffs on Canada and Mexico, and trade experts thought he might do that on day one, but we didn't see that. Instead, he signed an executive action calling on a bunch of federal agencies to investigate existing trade policy and send him their findings by April. But last night, he also said this.
We're thinking in terms of 25% on Mexico and Canada because they're allowing vast numbers of people. Canada's a very bad abuser also. Vast numbers of people to come in and fentanyl to come in.
And a reporter followed up and asked when he might enact those tariffs.
I think February 1st.
Asma, I want to back up a bit if we can. He said he wants to do this because of, quote, vast numbers of people. But what does he mean by that?
He's saying he wants to do this to curb immigration and illegal drugs coming over the border. And Juana, this is not the first time he's tried this tactic. You might recall back in his first term, Trump said he would put a tariff on all imports from Mexico until Mexico took steps to reduce illegal immigration. Mexico did take some steps, so Trump backed off his threat. And as we all know, immigration was a huge part of Trump's reelection campaign. A bunch of the executive actions that he signed yesterday are aimed at limiting immigration.
Right, but as we said, there is a trade deal with these two countries.
That's right. It's called the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, also known as USMCA, and it's a trade deal that the Trump administration signed when it was last in office. But the deal is up for review next year. I spoke to Kathleen Clausen about that. She's a professor at Georgetown who works on international trade law.
At this point, the Trump administration may be seeking to extract more from each of them in exchange for keeping the deal alive.
So this also may be a negotiating tactic, although Trump told reporters tonight that it had nothing to do with it. Though if history is any guide, this is a review that we are going to hear a lot about in the next couple of years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so much history here. I mean, I remember all of the back and forth with Canada and Mexico over trade in Trump's first term, and there were tariffs slapped on things like steel and lumber.
Mm-hmm. And remember, Canada, they issued retaliatory tariffs on things like beef and bourbon. Mexico put tariffs on U.S. pork. There was a lot of tit for tat. Eventually, these tariffs were lifted and a trade deal was struck. Canada and Mexico are among the United States' largest trading partners. You're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars. And so already you're hearing about possible retaliation. Take a listen to Anita Anand, one of Canada's key cabinet ministers on CTV television over the weekend.
We have planned multiple rounds of counter tariffs against the United States, which we will not hesitate to use if necessary.
Canada hasn't spelled out a plan in public, but the United States relies on a lot of oil and gas from Canada.
Asma, one thing before we let you go, I'm hoping you can just take a step back quickly, help us understand what it would mean if these tariffs go into effect.
Yeah, you know, Trump talks about these tariffs as taxes on other countries, but the tariffs are paid by American companies that import those goods. They often pass along the costs to their customers. Most economists say that tariffs actually end up as taxes on consumers, and some warn that if Trump goes through with this all, it could lead to higher inflation here at home.
NPR's Asma Khalid, thank you.
Good to speak with you.
With a handful of executive actions, President Trump has quickly reshaped the U.S. immigration landscape. Many people who'd been hoping to enter the United States are now in limbo. NPR's Eder Peralta is just across the southern border in Juarez, Mexico. Hi, Eder.
Hey, Ari.
Eder, tell us more about where you are and what you're seeing.
So, Ari, President Trump has declared a national emergency along this border, saying that America's sovereignty is under attack. But here, as you can hear, it's quiet. I'm at the foot of one of the bridges that leads to El Paso, and we drove up and down this fence, the border fence, and there are no migrants. And there's two reasons for that. The main one is that President Trump is inheriting a very quiet border. Over his 4 years in power, President Biden tightened asylum rules and he pressured Mexico to stop migrants from reaching the border. And just before he left office, apprehensions at the border were lower than they were when Trump left office the first time. But it's also quiet because migrants have no idea what to do. We've been out today and we've been talking to migrants sitting in parks and on stoops, and they're confused, they're sad, they're desolate, and they just don't know what to do because yesterday Trump shut down the only real path toward crossing the U.S. legally, and that was this thing called the CBP1 app. It allowed migrants to book appointments across to cross the border and ask U.S. authorities for asylum, but that is no more.
And you were at the border yesterday when these first policies made their impact. How did people react to it?
It was dramatic. Some migrants had waited nearly a year to get an appointment, and a few dozen of them had an appointment just after. It was scheduled for just after inauguration. They lined up, some starting at 5 a.m., hopeful that maybe their appointments would be honored. But shortly after Donald Trump took the oath of office, cell phones lit up. Migrants got a message that their appointments were no longer valid. Margelis Tinoco, a migrant from Venezuela, kneeled on the ground and she prayed. Let's listen. And what she's saying there is she's saying, my God, why me? Dear Lord, she said, why so much pain? And reporters asked her, what would you tell President Trump if you could talk to him?
Que tenga compasión. Que tenga compasión y lo deje cruzar. Que de verdad venimos sufriendo. 6 meses de sufrimiento.
And she's saying, I tell him to have compassion, to let us cross. It's been 6 months of suffering. I think what's important to note here is that Tinoco, like all the migrants in that line, had scored an appointment to cross the border legally. A lot of them had been waiting in Mexico for months, applying every day for a chance to present their case to U.S. authorities. And yesterday, their dreams were crushed.
These changes also obviously affect Mexicans who have no intention of coming to the U.S. What is the Mexican government saying?
Well, look, there's two big ways in which it affects Mexico. First, because Trump has essentially shut the border to migrants and it has reinstated a policy known as Remain in Mexico. And that means migrants from all over the world trying to reach the U.S. would have to apply for asylum from Mexico. And second, they're worried that Trump has promised mass deportations of undocumented migrants. And that could mean a lot of Mexicans. And here in a big parking lot just down the street, members of the civil defense are building a tent city that they say could hold about 5,000 people. So they're getting prepared.
NPR's Eder Peralta reporting from Juarez, Mexico. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ari.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at progressivecommercial.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at metamucil.com. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice. At ajws.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
A generic training program can be a good way to improve your personal fitness or performance in a sport. But to truly get the most out of training, it's important to understand your body's personal health. Bone density, body composition, the microbiome in your gut, and many other factors impact fitness outcomes and can change how you think about exercise. On the next Line One, host Dr. Jillian Woodruff and her guest explore the intersection of personal health and athletics training. That's Line One, Wednesdays at 10 a.m., repeating at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1 or alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to KSKA Anchorage, also translating as K220 AM Girdwood, K216 BN Prudhoe Bay, and K261 EI Anchorage.